Ta-da-da-da-da-da-da. You can fill those in for your own purposes, friends. And so it's now time for the Whoopee Hour. Glad you joined us. I've been working on the railroad. Oh, boy, I'm walking along down the street there about 20 seconds ago. And you can smell it, you know? You can smell the passion season is about to break over us. Can't you feel it? Every year, when it starts getting hotter and hotter and the temperature's about 90 degrees and you can smell Jersey festering over there, you can smell the Hudson River moving along there under those dark Stygian skies, you can feel the excitement of the fantastic passions. The nutty season is about to begin. And you can see the signs everywhere. For example, here's a little note in the New York Times here. And it's, you know, that's a very official paper, although they have their department, which could be called a silly section. And a little note here, it says, genuine new Lincoln penny with famous Batman emblem imprinted next to Lincoln, $5 for $1. Can you figure that out? I mean, I can see this guy named Morty. See, he's out in Staten Island, and he's sitting there, and he's trying to figure out a way to make some dough. And all of a sudden it hits him. He says, "Hey, Sam! Hey, Sam, I got an idea. We get, you know them presses they used at the World's Fair, you know, what you put a penny in, and out comes the penny squashed, and on the other side of the penny is a thing that says, drive safely, and on the other side then comes the Lord's Prayer. You remember that bit? Listen, I got an idea. What's the biggest thing today in the business?" "Oh, no, no, come on, play it straight, Sam. Come on, what's the biggest thing in the business today, huh?" "All right, I'll tell you, wise guy. Batman. That's right, Batman. All right, okay, now, what's the biggest president we ever had, huh? Lincoln. One penny. It costs us to get a penny with a Lincoln on it, huh? All right, we take the Lincoln penny, we put a Batman next to it, we sell him five for a buck, we get an ad in the Times, and the dough will just start..."
Ah, yes. And tonight, we here at this very serious radio station salute that little spark that lies within the soul of mankind. That little spark of romanticism. That little spark which is always reaching for the brass ring and hoping that any minute now, the next traffic jam will unravel and on the other side will be that great Howard Johnson in the sky. Bring it up, Bacon. And so tonight, we salute Paradise Enow. This has got to be done big. If it was Robert Goulet you were doing it for, you'd bring it in big. Bring it up. Do you know that Goulet's teeth work by batteries? Bring it up. What's so funny about that? They light up. You ought to see Sammy Davis's. Oh, wow. Bring it up. Fantastic. Magnificent. Reset that now. We're going to need that. Oh, yes, this is the time of the year. It's beginning to pop, bubble, and hiss, and boil.
In fact, I have a little sad story here that I want to relay to you here. Hello, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, a little sad story here I want to relay to you. And it comes from the kid. I just want you to know what's going on out there. And he's one of those college-type kids, you know, and it's sweeping all over colleges, this business of the computer dating. Have you seen that? Oh, it's called... It's got different names in different parts of the country, like Computo Date, which I kind of think is kind of nice, or some of them are a little obscene. I can't give them to you at this hour, but they're kind of clever. But, you know, the whole bit, it's a whole business of getting a date, you know, by the computer. And the way you do this, you fill out this fantastic form about all your qualifications and the things you like good music, you think clean thoughts, you're interested in liberal causes, and you're looking for a girl who is a magnificent, fantastic blonde who plays the zither and stuff. All right, now, here is a sad story. No, he sent this to me, and I'm holding this up to show you what is happening in our time. This is going in my vast box of dynamic trivia, and it's going to be, I think, 5,000 years from now, they're going to know, and they're going to want to know, certainly, where we went wrong. He sent this to me, photostated. Now, it's photostated, it's very official, and on the top of the letter is a photostat of the IBM card, which he received from the IBM date people. And it says, would you please give me a little of this beautiful music there? Because we believe that the chorus of true love is certainly about to be totally smoothed out by various tapes, computer systems, and all the other jazz, which we know makes life much easier to live. You know. And makes it foolproof. Which means that it makes it proof against almost all of us. In fact, I've never once yet a man who wasn't a fool. Oh, no, I mean including me, so don't think for a minute that I'm excluding myself. It says, answers on your questionnaire have been carefully programmed into our IBM computer. On our last processing, the names and telephone numbers listed below were the best compared selections. Remember, boys, it's up to you to make the first call. Very good. Now reset that, Matt. Right, reset that. Now, do you want to hear what the computer said about our listener? This is one of our listeners. And it's written. Have you noticed that kind of computer writing? Have you noticed that peculiar chaotic writing that is written on the bottom of your checks? You know, numbers you can hardly read and sixes that look like they're kind of backwards and sort of Sanskrit. You've seen them, Matt. And they all look like they're filled in little blots. And this is written in that computer, that kind of strange computer language, as though it's a little bit tongue-tied, but exceedingly glib. Very glib and very official. Bring this on now. We'll give you his answer. It says... I'll try to talk like a computer here. You have been compared by IBM computers against our entire file of the opposite sex. Because of your unusual characteristics, we cannot find any matches for you at this time. However, your name will be kept in the computer memory to be compared against any possible future applicants who might fit. 0011588 101822219. Richard, New York, New York. Number 101822110228, 0228, reject.
Oh! Rejected by the computer dating system. Oh, boy, there's a guy that's going to really write a novel about searching for his identity. Holy smokes. Oh, wow. Bring it up big, man. Oh, wow.
Smashing room. And, you know, he goes on to say, and he says, and you know, the worst part of it is, he says, I've been doing okay with chicks. And he says, I sent off this $3, and this thing came back, and he says, and ever since that time, my morale has been completely destroyed. And he says, you know, the funny part of it is, once he looked at that card, it's got all those little holes all over it, you know? It says, don't bend. It says, do not use spindle on. You know, I do some rotten things sometimes. You know, the other night, I spent 2 hours spindling cards. I got this little spindle that I bought in this little joint, this crummy little rotten joint off 48th Street, where they sell bootleg spindles that you can use to spindle IBM cards before you send them back to the bank. And I spindled it. You know, it's not easy to learn to use a spindle. And this card says, you know, do not use spindles. It says, do not bend. This is an official card. And it has official date, official addresses. And it's all marked out. It says IBM Corporation. And it's got all those little blue lines and red lines and green lines all over. And he says, I looked at this thing. And he says, you know, for a long moment, my mind boggled. He says, and I sat there and I put it down. I looked at it again. And he says, and everybody in my family is sympathetic now. And they say, it's okay. It's kind of a compliment that the IBM dating system has rejected you. And he says, but yet he's not so sure. He says, you know, I don't know whether this is a compliment or not. When you are rejected by a taped memory, boy, there is no going back, because you could write a fantastic poem and show it to this thing and it doesn't do anything. I mean, you could go back for a long fly ball in the outfield and make a catch and the IBM machine just looks at you. A chick might be just a little bit impressed, but not an IBM machine. And so everywhere you can see, if you smell that air, that hot, heady summertime air, that the nutty season is about to break on us. Oh, yeah, it's all over. I went out to the ball game last night, and I could smell it in the ballpark. Matt, have you got my baseball music in there? We're going to need that. You know, I noticed one very important thing at the ballpark. The new fan does not give a you-know-what for baseball. He's part of a gigantic television show. And I couldn't figure out what was happening. You know, the ball players were hitting balls and they were running out and making spectacular catches. And everybody around me was looking the other way. And I saw what it was. They were watching Lindsey Nelson, who was the real star of a ball game to most of them out there. They were waiting for Bob Murphy. In fact, they even had one sign that they held up. Did you see that sign? It says, go, Lindsey! And poor old Hawk Taylor just hit a home run. Nobody watched. They were waiting to see Lindsey Nelson, whatever his, they got the dullest announcers in the world. And the camera, you see, I could see great waves of people all, if you sit in Shea Stadium, it's a real revelation. You see these great waves of people. It's not like Yankee Stadium where the fans are sort of concealed under those great big overhanging stands. And they can't see the TV cameras, most of them, you know, when you're sitting in the stands at Yankee Stadium. But out there at Metsville, out in Shea Stadiumsville, that is a TV show in the round, literally. And you can see waves of people. You wonder what's going on. It's like a big sea wave. You just see people go, and they're all turning, and the ball game is going on down there, and you just see them turning, and you know what's happening. Up on the upper deck, somebody has turned a red light on them, and they're all waving and cheering, and they're holding up their signs, and they're doing their little shticks. Some guys are auditioning. One guy jumped up and stood on the seat and started to sing, there's no business like show business. He was hoping that Richard Rodgers was at home watching the TV set and would see him and say, who's that man there in section 4, row 8? The one next to the hot dog man. He's fantastic. He'll do the Mary Martin show next year. And the camera moved up and down, and I realized that the Mets, and in fact all the ballpark people, are missing a great point. They're missing a tremendous promotional bit. How many times have you heard the TV announcers say, yeah, folks, we want you to come out next week. Don't forget, it's Old Timers Day. We're going to celebrate Old Timers of 1950, and they're going to relive the big game, the All-Star Game of 1950, and that's going to follow immediately Cap Day. We're going to give away caps next Wednesday. Thursday will be Old Timers Day, and after that it will be Bat Day. And then we're going to have Senior Citizens Day out here. Just once, wouldn't it be nice if they had a day called Baseball Day, where they do nothing but play baseball, so they give away caps and hats and bats and have old-timers, Senior Citizens Day, and they're going to salute the world's biggest flag this week and all that stuff. And I've got an idea for some real days. Bring some days on there. Let's go. For the fan of today, I mean, who doesn't give a you-know-what for baseball, but who still likes to go out to the ballpark because he sees it on television, how about this one, folks? The announcer comes on, your attention, please. Your attention, please. We are announcing for next Wednesday, June 28th, next Wednesday, June 28th, will be Foul Ball Day. Yes, we will celebrate Foul Ball Day out here at Shea Stadium at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Bring your gloves, bring your fielder's mitts, and two of our coaches will hit foul balls into the stands for 2 hours. And then you and your friends can do nothing but chase foul balls for 2.5 hours and not be bothered to have to turn around and look and see that ball game that keeps going on while you're chasing foul balls. And you will be allowed to come to Foul Ball Day for the price of 1 general admission ticket. So come on out. It's next Wednesday, an off day. The Mets will be traveling. We will celebrate Foul Ball Day. Be on hand. Have you noticed they get more excited over a foul ball than they do over a home run now? Oh, I think foul ball day is a natural. How about this one?
Your attention, please. Your attention, please. Next Sunday at 2 p.m. at Shea Stadium, the Mets will celebrate Wave at the TV Camera Day. 2 full-hours of waving at the television camera. We will station 2 cameras, one back of third base, one back of first base, and we will do nothing but sweep the crowd, sponsored by Rheingold Beer, and for 2 solid hours, you can wave to your friends who stay at home. For the price of 1 admission, Wave at the TV Camera Day will be celebrated next week. So come on out.
I kind of like this one, too.
Your attention, please. Next Wednesday at 2 o'clock, the Mets will celebrate Jump on the Field Day. When all of you can jump on the field, run around the park, pretend you're sliding into second base, and you will be allowed to throw all papers you want on home plate and on the pitcher's mound. And we will keep all fuzz off the field, and you can jump on the field all you want that day. Jump on the Field Day will be celebrated next week, and you'll all be on television, of course. And Lindsay Nelson will provide the deathless, colorful description. Jump on the Field Day next week at the same time. And your attention, please. Your attention, please. As part of our big doubleheader next week, we are going to celebrate Eat Hot Dogs and Drink Beer Day, where all of you fans out there who come to the ballpark only to eat hot dogs and drink beer can come out and drink hot dogs and drink beer to your heart's content and not be bothered by foul balls or other people who insist on watching the ball game and keep hollering, "Sit down in front." You can have all the fun you want next Sunday on Eat Hot Dogs and Drink Beer Day. And by the way, all of you will be allowed to throw your beer cups on the stand and on the field all you want. So come on out and celebrate this with all of us here.
Oh, wow. Cha-da-cha-da-cha. You know, I have an idea for a television show, and that's a TV show. You know, I think most TV shows have neglected the audience completely. Most people don't want to go in to watch a show anymore. Have you ever seen the apathetic looks of the people watching a television show? Speaking of apathy, this is WNACAM and WRKO-FM in Boston. Speaking of chicanery in the good old summertime, in the good old summertime. La cha da cha, cha cha da cha. Oh, there is no time like the hot, steamy, dark fastnesses of the summertime to bring out the true nuttiness of people. And, you know, in fact, have you noticed that the hotter the climate, the more volatile the people? This is a fact. a fact that the historians have noted for a long time. I remember one time as a kid. Now, I don't know whether you ever ran across this theory, but have you ever seen the globe divided up into various sections by climate? And they divide it up. And you remember in school they were always giving you a picture of the globe, and they used to say, fill in the horse latitudes. Fill in the equatorial latitudes and so on. And I remember one time, one teacher, and I don't recall what grade it was or anything, but I remember one time getting this globe, and it was she had it all mimeographed and dittoed and everything else, and she had the globe divided up into various zones that were the best for the human animal. Just like, you know, when they show you maps, fishing maps. Have you ever seen fishing maps where they will show you the different parts of a country that is best for different types of fish? For example, let's take the smallmouth bass. The smallmouth bass only grows in a certain area of the it's all climate. Only in a certain latitude and longitude will the smallmouth bass grow. You go too far north, you don't catch them. Too far south, and they hardly ever exist anymore. Well, you know, this is the way with man. We're an animal. And there is a climate where we are at our very best. And it's a combination of climate, humidity, a combination of a lot of factors, but it all boils down to environment. There's an environment that man grows best in and is the best kind of animal. Now, he proliferates in other climates better. In other words, he may be very like certain fish, can be very prolific in certain parts of the world, but they don't grow to a large size. They're second-rate fish. Did you know any of these theories? So this lady had the globe, and we had to divide it up into different parts where mankind was at his very best. Now, it is a fact that in the hotter climates, man has never quite achieved the same kind of achievements that he has in the more temperate climates. Very few, for example, very few books, very few great plays have been written by people who live in the tremendously hot, almost, where almost all of your energy is taken up in just being alive and just continuing to live. So much of your energy pours out of you, so you don't have that excess energy to pour into abstract works like poetry, like writing, one thing and another. So I wonder just what happens when you take people like we are. We're largely temperate people. We live in temperate climates. By that I mean we live in places where the temperature may be an average of 50 degrees. The humidity may be an average of 45, maybe something like that. When all of a sudden it is 95, the humidity is 98, what does that do to us as an animal? What does that do? Almost any good horseman will tell you that many horses will run differently in cold weather, hot weather, different kinds of weather. It changes their behavior pattern entirely. And so here it is now. It's the beginning of summer, and the nutty season is beginning to settle in. I remember, here's an example of it. The little nuttinesses that pop out. I wonder whether this would happen in the wintertime. It's just a big social event of the season. Here's a little note from the paper. Is the premiere of the Shakespeare Festival in Central Park and the supper dance at the Plaza on Monday. 25 young New York notables will come costumed as Shakespearean heroines. Lee Remick will come as Hippolyta, Pamela Tiffin as Kate, Susan Stein as Ophelia, Allegra Kent as Cassandra, Gloria Steinem will come as Lady Macbeth, and Susan Conner will come as Hamlet. There's one of your famous heroines. I've always thought there was something wrong with Hamlet, and maybe she's hit on a new interpretation. Next Saturday, now I'm going to demand this. I don't demand much of my long-suffering listener types out there, but I am going to demand, they demand a hell of a lot from me, but I don't demand much from you. And this is what I am going to demand, that as of this Saturday, I'm going to play in the Yankee Stadium lineup. You know that lineup they've got? Of radio and TV people. Every year during June, before a Yankee game, they have a game that we play, and it's real. I mean, they play. Jerry Coleman is the coach of one team, and Phil Rizzuto is the coach of the other. And they play it for keeps, really. And you have no idea what a fantastic feeling it is as an old sports fan, and as a guy who played a lot of ball in his time. You know, we've all played baseball one kind or another, and as a guy who's played ball. To stand up at home plate at Yankee Stadium. Now, this is the real Yankee Stadium. It's no fake. To stand up at home plate against, you know, in Yankee Stadium wearing a Yankee uniform with a bat in your hand and 25,000 people watching. Now, I don't care whether it's the fat guys against the skinny guys. You're wearing a Yankee uniform. You are at the same home plate that Babe Ruth stood at, that Joe DiMaggio stood at, that Phil Rizzuto stood at, that all the great ball players, you know, you dig in and you look around and you hear, wah! You know, and you look back and there is a catcher behind you. And he's down in the crouch and you see up on the mound a pitcher wearing a Yankee uniform is winding up and is about to throw an official American League baseball right down the slot at you. And you can see that green wall out there just on the other side of that hump, you know, just past the infield. You see that long green line that says 358, and then it slants away. It says 407, then there's a great big board that says visitors, then it says New York, then there's another slot that says 420. Oh, boy, and can you imagine what a feeling that is? Oh, seriously, now, as a ball fan. Now, you laugh, but seriously, can you imagine that? And they're televising it, of course. And you can see the TV cameras and 20,000 people. And then there's a wind-up in the pitch. It's a low inside pitch, but it's knee-high, and it's in the strike zone. You swing, and you foul it off to the right. It goes up over the first baseline, you know, and curves into the stands right above the dugout. And you see the crowd fighting for the ball. And, of course, you walk away. And you don't even watch. You spit. You don't even bother to look where the ball went. Oh, that fantastic feeling. And you've got on the back of your uniform, you've got a big number, you see. And the announcer says,
"And now, batting second and playing third base, number 11, Jay Shepard. Number 11, now playing third."
Oh, what a fan. And it echoes from one end of the stadium to the other. Back and forth, you hear this. So I am going to demand that a few of you get out there this Sunday. And that when I come to bat, you know, I want to hear this roar, you know, "Go, go, go." All right, enough of that. Hey, you know, speaking of the crazy, of the nutty season, are you a collector? Yeah, it's Saturday. What did I say, Sunday? It is Saturday, friends. It is Saturday, and it will be before the Yankee game. I think we start playing, don't we, at something like 1 o'clock? And you know how they do this game? I'll tell you, they really do this right. This will be the third year that I've played. I'll never forget the first year up. I got up to bat the first time, and Jerry Coleman was pitching. And Coleman winds up and throws a pitch, and I swung, and I got a hold of it. You know that great feeling of really getting a hold of one? That, you know, you've got a hold of it, and I saw that thing sliding out, curving over second base, out, and on the first hop, it bounced off the wall in right center. Oh, what a feeling. You stand on second base, you know, and you spit. You look around, you tug at your hat, you scratch, you know. And the announcer, you can hear the announcer, and there he is at second base with a hard double off the right field wall. Oh, what a feeling. But you know, this strange feeling of being in a slot. Now, we all laugh. Of course, the baseball, non-baseball fans are out there saying, "Ah, you know, wah, wah, wah." All right, now let's put it into an area. Let's put it into an area that you might approve of. Let's say, can you imagine one time sitting down at the desk, the same desk, you know, you're sitting at the desk of, let's say, the President of the United States. And you're sitting at the desk. And there are all those phones all around you, you see. And a man walks in, and he's got a scratch pad, and he says, "We are waiting your decision. Would you please sign these bills?" And he hands you these bills, and you start signing them. Wouldn't it be a great feeling just once? Wouldn't it just once? You write down Charlie Appelrod, and you hand somebody your ballpoint pen. You know, I like that idea of giving away your pen. Everything you write is so fantastic that people all cheer and yell and want the ballpoint pens. And you know, today, one of the big expenses in the White House is the president has to have a whole collection of these ceremonial ballpoint pens he gives away. So he writes one letter. You know, he'll write L, and he gives the pen to somebody. Then he writes B, he gives the pen to somebody else. J, and he gives it away, you know. O, H, and that there are 728 pens for the signing of one bill. And they're special pens. Can you imagine the ballpoint pens? It says, "Eat at Rikers," says on the side. You know, he could get a terrific little concession going on the side. Or vote for me, you know. Oh, yeah, you know. I wonder when industry is really going to really start playing up the ceremonial side big, Matt. I can see it going big. You know, for example, let's take the radio station here. It signs a gigantic deal with Chicanery Products Incorporated. And they sell this exploding cleanser. You know, this real cockamamie thing. You know, they've got toothpaste that tastes like bourbon. They put it on the market, and they sell dirty pictures and all that stuff. And we signed a gigantic $200,000 contract. And can you see the manager there with our TV cameras grinding, and he's giving away ceremonial pens to all the salesmen as he... You know, big moments like that. And I think that we should have, for example, in industry, I think industry is missing out a great deal on theatrics. For example, when a man is fired and another man takes his place, I think that it should be done with ceremony. Can you imagine a guy giving his inauguration speech as he's inaugurated to be the head of production here at the radio station, and he's taking over the desk that has been so ably filled by Jack Stewart? And he arrives, and that we have the lights dimmed, you know, and we've got music playing. "Hail to the chief." He goes, "Ta ta 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 ta." And he brings in his favorite poet to read some cockamamie poem about taking the torch from failing hands as once again man stands on the precipice of great deeds. And, you know, some Robert Frost with the wind blowing in his eye. Da, 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 da. And so then he gives a speech, and he stands up there, and of course they'd have to swear him in. Now, I don't know what they'd swear him in here in show business. Maybe on a copy of Player's Guide. Or possibly they'd have him swear on the RAB ratings. They give him a copy of last month's ratings book. And, of course, we believe in that like a Bible. And he swears on it. I swear to uphold the traditions of this fantastic public-spirited institution of which I am now taking a small part and a tiny helm in. I swear in the name of God to make all the dough that we can make. All right, thank you. And now, and then they go, ta 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 ta, hail to the chief, you see. Either that, or what would be a great theme song for a chief in this cockamamie business? Huh? Played by the Marine Band. And he finishes, and then he gives his speech. Fellow Americans and fellow workers in the great vineyard of the communications industry, we together will march forward to higher ratings. I am going to get this master control room on the stick. There will be no sitting around and picking your teeth during station breaks. Engineers will stop griping about when their vacation schedule is set up a full year in advance. We certainly cannot start arguments about the 1969 vacation schedule as early as 1965, which we have had seen in the last few years here. I think eventually we would learn to have far more respect for the men over us. If they are sworn in and they have to rent a tuxedo when they take their job, when they march in. And of course, when a man is fired, we could even do it more than that. Much bigger. You know, when have you ever seen the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace? You imagine what happens when a salesman here gets the mitten at WOR and they call the entire group in. In full uniform, all in gray flannel suits, all dressed up, you know, and they've got their gray ties on, and they're wearing their gray BVDs and everything, and everybody is standing there, and they celebrate the changing of the guard with crossed martini glasses, and they stand there with their glasses, you know. I always liked those great moments when I was a kid. I'm reading G8 and his Battle Aces, you know. Did you ever read G8 and his Battle Aces? And stories of World War One, romantic stories of the Flyers, the Aces of that period. You know what happened when, what they always did? Do you know the phrase that they always used when one of the Flyers was shot down? I'll award, now you talk about trivia. All right, I will award the brass figure with bronze oak leaf palm. He was said to have gone, what's the phrase? No. It was a classic phrase used in all those great dramas of World War One. You know where you see Erich von Stroheim as the evil German captain, and he has just shot down our hero, and he is peeling his white gloves off, and he's, that's right, how did you know that? None of those guys knew that. All right, come on now. All right, we'll award the listener a brass figurine if he can tell me what that was. And they used to stand there when one of the wingmates was shot down over no man's land, and they have returned in their spads, you know, those great moments when B flight came winging in low over no man's land, and 8 planes went out and only 7 are returning. And the laughing, gay, white-teethed Captain Ralph Armstrong had gone you know where, see, and he was the hero of the mess. He had shot down 27 of the checkerboard-nosed Fokker squadrons, and now he is gone. And they fly in low, and they come over. Here's what they would do. They always in these stories, I would read it one, my tongue would hang out. It says the squadron leader, his eyes narrowed to mere slits, gave a curt signal, a nod to his wingmates, first to the left and to the right, and then wagging the wings of his checkerboard nose spad, he buzzed the tarmac. And then, as he chandelled up sharply at the end of the runway, he dropped the white silk handkerchief that had been worn by Captain Ralph Armstrong in his last battle. Wow! And it fluttered like a silver bird from that high blue sky, the sky that had proved to be the most deadly avenger of all. And then, later that night, as the pilots sat around their mess. Not a word was said to their fallen comrade until at long last the squadron leader stood and raising his glass of cognac high, he said to Ralph. And he held that glass long, and far off in the distance you could hear the thunder of the guns on the western front. You could hear the sound of the Fokkers coming in for their night patrol. He says to Ralph. And then he, with a single gulp, he downed the cognac. And then, what did he do with his glass? Come on. He hurled the glass into the crackling fireplace. And one after the other, silently, the wingmates toasted their fallen comrade. And the crash of the glass, one after the other, blended with their great pile of glass from other fallen comrades. End of chapter 3. The next chapter, The Blood Red Avenger. Do you want to hear that one? Baron von Richthofen climbed slowly, methodically, into his Fokker triplane D-tool. As he settled himself in his leather seat, pulled on tight and strapped it hard in his safety belt, and glanced once at the two deadly Spandau machine guns that lay just over his cowling. You want to hear that? The sound of the Fokker engine clawed at the brilliant dawn air, cold and hard. And finally, it spun into life. Doesn't that sound like a rotary gnome engine? Baron von Richthofen rolled out on the tarmac, a lone, solitary figure about to meet his maker. Little did he realize that yesterday afternoon, his 81st victory was to be his last. 200 miles away, a young Canadian pilot climbed into his SE-5. He was just new at the front, still nervous. Oh, already you could see the signs of fear cleaving. Well, you got that picture, huh? 10 minutes later, two flights of enemy planes climbed into the brilliant blue sky. The dreaded checkerboard-nosed, blood-red Fokkers of Baron Richthofen's circus climbed higher and higher. The deadly Avengers, the killers of the sky. On the other side of the lines, Captain Billy Bishop and his flight of SE-5s. Hey, you want to hear more of this? All right, one other thing, too. Well, you notice none of the listeners knew? One listener called in, he knew. What was it? The great word that all flyers, when they... only flyers, as far as I know, were referred to in that term. When they were shot down in action in World War I, they were referred to as having gone where? That's right. And another thing they used to always do in the early days of aerial combat, when a man was shot down, let's say he was a SPAD pilot, and he was shot down over the lines, in the German lines, and he'd had a fantastic combat. And, of course, all the troops would watch these combats, and finally he would come slowly snaking down through the sky, trailing black, oily smoke, and then you see the top wing peels off, and down and down and down he comes. These were very light airplanes. They didn't come down like the big heavy metal planes. They just sort of floated down like a leaf, drifting down, trailing smoke until finally, and it would be a big billow of black smoke and red flame, and that would be the end of a SPAD. And immediately all the ground troops would converge on it. And then the pilot, quite often, the pilot who had shot him down would try to land. He would land in that area and come over. And you know why he did this? He came over to see who it was, to get his dog tags, and to get his effects, maybe to pick up his scarf, his helmet, maybe his wallet, and he would put them in this silk bag that he would make out of the scarf that they all wore, and 20 minutes later he would fly over the fallen Aces airdrome or the fallen pilot's airdrome, and he would come in low. He would buzz it with his Fokker, and they would know that he's there for a reason. And they would not even try to touch him, see? And then he would go up into the sky, and he would be saluting the fallen comrade. And he would drop out of his plane this white scarf containing the effects of this guy. Then they would have a full military burial where all the German officers would gather to salute the fallen ace. And this would happen on both sides of the line. It wasn't just one side of the line. It was both sides of the line. Who was the ace? As a kid, I was deeply involved in reading all this stuff. You know, it's just like nobody's really done anything on this in the movies. Can you tell me the name of the flyer, the famous flyer, who one time took on a flight of 80 planes? I believe it was 80 planes, 80 Fokkers at once. And he was, I believe, a British flyer. In fact, I know he was. He took on a flight of 80 planes all by himself and fought them for 15 minutes all over the sky. It was considered the greatest single aerial combat of World War I. He's a genuine legend. And this was after this fellow, I think, had shot down something like 40 or 50 planes before that. And now, one day, he ran into this giant flight of incoming enemy aircraft, German aircraft, and he held them up. He fought them for over 15 minutes, and in the fight, he shot down five of them, fantastically outnumbered. And then finally, they shot him down, and that day, he was such a heroic fighter that day there were black rim presses all over Germany that this great heroic fighter had gotten shot down. Do you know the name of that guy? That was a fascinating guy. And the other day, I'm in the dime store, see? And you know, they have all these little plastic airplanes all over, these little models. And here is an airplane, and it says it was an SE-5. And it says this is an exact copy of the plane that was flown by blank. I won't tell you his name. And they get a lot of people walking around. And I saw this there, and I thought, I wonder if anybody knows the story of this fantastic character. And then right next to it was another plastic model, and it says this is a SPAD that is the exact copy of the plane that was flown by, and this was the name of an American cowboy, a fascinating character who was almost exactly like the character that Gary Cooper played. You know, the tall, rangy, taciturn Western man who came out of the West and learned to fly a SPAD and was almost court-martialed a dozen times because he could not fly with other people. He fought only alone. And he became a fantastic ace, and his entire career lasted something like 14 days, during which time he accounted for 21 aircraft. Something like 21 aircraft, including... And he was known as the Balloon Buster. What was his name? Fabulous character. And he was shot down, finally, when they shot him down, he was shot down by a machine gun that was hidden in a church spire. He was flying that low. He crashed amid the headstones and finally fought it out with German ground troops and a pistol before they finally got him. What a character. What was this guy's name? There you are, see? There's a little plastic plane in Woolworth, and it says this is a plane that is an exact copy of this man's plane. He flew a SPAD, by the way, and was known as the Balloon Buster. Now, why do I know all this trivia? I'm sure a lot of guys are going to think that I was contemporary to that. No, not at all. That's Ed Fitzgerald's world. It just so happened that, like some kids, you know, get hooked on the Civil War, they read all about it. I got hooked on aces.